If you like what you hear, let us know by becoming an official supporter of the Pop Culture Preservation Society on Patreon. This show is created, researched, produced, distributed, edited, and paid for by us, Kristen, Carolyn, and Michelle. And your support allows us to keep the lights on and keep on trucking. For the price of one or two cups of coffee a month, you can become a supporter by going to poppreservationists.com and clicking on the Patreon link. Or go to our link in bio on Instagram and find the Patreon link in our link tree. We appreciate you and thank you so much for helping us do what we love. There was some woman that she talked to who was riding the bus to school one day, and the bus driver said, "Hey, did you hear they're filming a movie with John Travolta?" And she said, "Nobody went to school that day."
I know, they all
skipped school, and they're all hanging on a subway platform. They're mobbing the subway platform so they can watch the filming, so much so that the subway trains can't even get in.
Hello world, is a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
Welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the big wheel generation whose idea of an insult involved inviting people to insert rubber hoses into their noses.
Sure.
Up your nose with a rubber hose.
Why wouldn't you?
We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear like Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
And today, we're kicking off Season 17 with a book club tailor-made for disco-loving Gen Xers. We're celebrating the release of the book Fever, a complete history of Saturday Night Fever.
I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle. And we are your pop culture preservationists.
Welcome to Disco Book Club, the only book club that we know of that has disco as its guiding principle. Today's book club pick is made to order for the Gen X children of the Pop Culture Preservation Society, simply called Fever, A Complete History of Saturday Night Fever by Margot Donahue. We are going to be frank with you right now. Today, we were looking forward to sitting here with Margot, the author of Fever. Her publicist reached out to us several months ago and basically said, "You would love Margot. You are going to be best friends." And it looked like a match made in heaven, not just the subject matter, but Margot was also a pop culture podcaster. She was like a sister from another mister. We were going to get podcast married. We were so excited to meet her. But a few weeks before our interview date, I wanted a little more info about Margot so I could be prepared. I didn't want to sound like I didn't know who she was. And deep into that search, it was not the first thing that popped up. Deep into the search, I found something that stopped my heart for a minute. I came upon a community of people coming together and mourning after reading an announcement of Margot Donahue's sudden death. And I thought, this can't be real. And truthfully, for about 24 hours, we were convinced that this was a cruel and inappropriate hoax.
Mm-hmm. Because we couldn't find anything.
We couldn't find anything.
It was crazy weird.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I like how you said, and it stopped my heart, because that's how I felt too. Like, wait, and it's like I didn't know her, but the fact that we had this connection of her coming on the podcast and everything – it made me feel like we did.
We did know her. Yes.
And I felt like no, because there would be something out there. So no, this isn't right.
And I had just read her book. So I really did. As I read her book, I was getting to know her. And I did feel like I knew her. And I loved her. And so even though we had never spoken, this really was like a parasocial relationship. Like we knew this woman.
Mm-hmm.
So Carolyn very carefully, I mean, we had to have a lot of discussions about how do we approach this very unusual situation that we're in. So Carolyn very carefully reached out to Margot's publicist, who confirmed that yes, sadly, Margot Donahue had died very unexpectedly, just days before, less than a month before her new book was to be released. Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I was just, it was such a crushing blow because I had just gotten to know her by reading her book.
Like just reading her book, you get a sense of her voice, if that makes sense.
It's like you're talking with her.
And it really is. And they had just recorded a podcast episode about the book.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like that had to have been
days.
Moments. Like, and let's not forget, she had two other podcasts that are very popular that people are like devastated. They feel like they know her, much like our listeners feel like they know us.
She had a legion of fans. And that's what we had stumbled upon, were these fans talking about how much they were going to miss her. And we don't have any information about what happened. Nobody does. We are all in the dark and we are in shock. And we are so sad. So in tribute to her and to give her and her book the recognition that they deserve, I'm going to read from her obituary, just so we can all kind of celebrate her together.
Yeah.
Author, podcast producer, and host Margot Donahue, a longtime Brooklyn resident, has passed away unexpectedly at the age of 58. Margot lived in Park Slope, Brooklyn for nearly three decades, where she built a close-knit circle of friends who became her chosen family. A passionate music lover, pop culture trivia expert, and writer, Margot co-produced the Book Versus Movie podcast for 11 years and the Dorking Out and What a Creep podcasts for 8 years. That's three podcasts, people, for the people counting. She was also a contributing writer to numerous outlets in the health and wellness arena and a featured guest on countless culture podcasts. This work led to the publication of Margot's first book, Filmed in Brooklyn, which chronicles the rich and long cinematic history of her beloved Brooklyn. Her second book, Fever, The Complete History of Saturday Night Fever, will be released on August 26, 2025. When she passed, she had already begun work on her next book, A History of the Movie Carrie. Margot had a sharp wit, a generous heart, and an encyclopedic knowledge of movies and television, particularly Monty Python, which shaped her wonderfully quirky sense of humor. She could quote Spinal Tap and Pride and Prejudice with equal ease, often in the same conversation. She also dreamed of one day retiring with her closest friends and recreating the Golden Girls lifestyle, complete with sarcasm, snacks, and found family. Margot was deeply connected to those around her, both people and pets. When she made a friend, she kept them, often for decades. Her loyalty ran deep, and her relationships were rich with humor, honesty, and care. So you can see what a loss this is.
Yes. So obviously we were stunned to discover her death was in fact true. And we were just so sad.
Yeah.
And after a beat, obviously we're like, well, we need to scrap that episode on Fever. But then very quickly we knew that no, now more than ever, we needed to celebrate Margot's book, this passion project of hers, because by doing this, by having this conversation we're about to have, it will keep a huge part of Margot alive. This book lives on through the people who read and discuss it. And to let it die along with her would be a huge disservice to the life that she put into it.
Yeah, like you said, this was a passion project. This was personal for her. This is not just her job.
Yeah, I mean, so now it's up to people like us to keep this going, to keep this book going.
Right. In a way, I feel like she wrote it for us, for those people who grew up and had this really pop culture defining experience with Saturday Night Fever. And she has in the book a lot of the same questions that I have that she kind of answers for us. This book really was written for us. And what better way to honor her than to read it and discuss it and really be the beneficiaries of this gift that I think she was really giving a generation. So we are excited to share her work with you because really we are the most perfect audience for this book.
We really are. I mean, extremely so. It's no wonder that her publicist reached out to her, and she's right. We were going to be the best of friends. So this is for you, Margot. To introduce you to the book, I'm going to read to you word for word the introduction because it's brilliant and it just tells you everything that you need to know about this book that is, like Carolyn said, it's written for us. And it says, whether you're a brother or whether you're a mother, it's impossible to resist the throbbing disco beats and lasting cultural impact of Saturday Night Fever. Released in December 1977, this low-budget disco movie was the surprise gift that kept on giving. It made millions at the box office, earned an Oscar nomination for TV actor turned movie star John Travolta, catapulted the Bee Gees' music career into the stratosphere with a record-breaking, Grammy-winning soundtrack album, and ignited a disco inferno that burns to this day. From Travolta's iconic white polyester suit and legendary dance moves to the flashing lights and illuminated floor of the 2001 Odyssey Disco in Brooklyn, Saturday Night Fever captured the era like no other film and launched a phenomenon that changed the world forever. And you guys, we were there for it. I'm just so happy that we were there for it.
Mm-hmm. I know. Well, the editor-in-chief of the publisher of the book says that in this book, Margot has expertly captured the making of this remarkably groundbreaking movie, along with the soundtrack, the style, the dances, and the hair, which continues to resonate today across popular culture. And apparently, this Margot's book, Fever, is the first complete history of Saturday Night Fever, which is pretty astounding.
It is astounding.
50 years. Almost 50 years later, yeah. And what I loved about this book is that it's not only a deep dive into the making of the movie, and you guys know I love a good behind the scenes, you know, I love all those factoids and gossip, but this book includes interviews with actors, dancers, and crew from the movie, 62 of them.
That's a lot.
She has like them all listed. And it also explores the huge impact of the movie. And as many of you listening know, back in early 2022, the Pop Culture Preservation Society devoted two episodes to Saturday Night Fever, one for the movie and another for the soundtrack. And I just re-listened to episode 52, aptly titled Saturday Night Fever, Part One, the movie. You guys,
we're so clever.
I know. Our creativity was spinning that day. And other than some sound issues and that being the cringy season, we tried to incorporate an opening, casual, off-the-cuff host chat in every episode.
It's not us.
I can't even. You guys, hey, we spent 5 years throwing shit to the wall to see what sticks, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And thank God host chat did not.
It didn't last. Host chat didn't last.
But our discussion in episode 52, especially the last half hour, I think is really insightful and thought-provoking. That was one of our first forays into movies, like a movie discussion from our past that had a troubling plot and cringy scenes that we basically had a PhD level discussion about, and I'm proud of it. Even when I listen to that, I'm proud of the questions we posed and I'm proud of the thoughts that we had. Well, Margot's book, Fever, The Complete History of Saturday Night Fever, takes us even deeper into the making of the movie, including some of the more troubling scenes. Think Annette in the backseat of the car. Mm-hmm. But because she talks to the players, in this case, for that scene, Donna Pescow, Paul Pape, who played Double J, and Joseph Calley, who played Joe, and even Travolta's body double, who was everybody. And a lot of other like dancers and singers and even John Badham, the director, we get a first person account of not just what was happening during filming, but how many of these uncomfortable scenes affected their mindset during the entire shooting process, which actually answers a lot of the questions we posed in our own episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? I mean, when we first got this book, reaction was, well, we've already done an episode on Saturday Night Fever, so this would be redundant. But what we found is that we came to that episode with so many questions that we couldn't find the answers to.
Right.
We didn't realize we were going to have a PhD level discussion. We thought we were going to be talking about a fun dance movie, and that was not what happened. And so we left there with some lingering questions,
yeah.
And Margot answered them for us. Listening to that episode from so long ago when we were just learning how, like, Michelle referenced the sound issues. The sound is horrible. We were still learning all of the technical aspects of hosting a podcast. But you'll also hear us sort of haltingly discuss this in the beginning because we were unprepared for the movie. We had seen it when we were children and we had an idea in our heads of what it was, and it was not that. And so coming to it with our adult eyes and ears kind of through us. And so we had to find our bearings, and an hour and a half was not enough time for us to come to any sort of resolution on what the movie meant to us or what it meant to the world. And so I think this book was almost a healing experience mm-hmm. for me. Mm-hmm. There's one chapter in particular, we'll talk about it later, that is just about what is this movie about? What's it about? It's not a dance movie. And that's why we were struggling in the beginning to figure out what we were talking about. And then, mm-hmm. like Michelle said, the last half hour, we are really coming together and having such a deep conversation because we're realizing it was far deeper than we thought it was.
Well, yeah, and I really, listening back, was just really struck by my real-time revelations when we were yes. talking about mm-hmm. Annette and just how I could relate to her and kind of the position that she felt she was in to get the guy that she liked.
Annette was going to sacrifice anything. She was going to debase herself in order to get the guy.
Right. Yeah. And the book, and we'll come to talk about this in a little while, just kind of validated some of the things that I was saying. I felt kind of a balm as I was reading Donna Pascal's take on this whole mm-hmm. character and some of the scenes. Just that whole quandary of the good girl, bad girl dilemma, then you can't win for losing.
Yeah.
I do also want to say, I feel like maybe because it was so in real time and raw that I was kind of harsh when I was making it sound like all the guys I went to high school with were jerks and mistreated girls. It certainly was not all of the guys, really.
No,
I went to school with
okay.
some really yeah. nice guys. I felt bad.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I have to say, while some guys weren't doing these things, nobody was calling this out as wrong. Like this, right. again, was this era right. that we just thought, as whether the girls or you're a guy observing it, this is just the way of the world. And this is the way mm-hmm. some guys are.
Yeah.
So that part of our old episode, and then coupling that with reading the book, I've got a whole new perspective on everybody involved, the Annettes, yeah. the other men in the movie and the boys in my life. And I appreciated getting to revisit that moment in the podcast.
And I think it's because that, like, Kristen, to your point where you said in that last half hour, and I think I mentioned mm-hmm. it earlier too, mm-hmm. we kind of all locked in on, oh, like, I know that from the beginning of episode 52, because it was the first time I had ever seen the R-rated version,
right?
Like the week prior to us recording right. that in 2022. I was like, absolutely not. I can't stand this movie. I don't understand why. I don't understand any of it. By the end of our conversation, I had done like a 180. I had been like, oh, yeah, I do see a lot of it. And so I think now what Fever did for me reading Margot's book, and Carolyn, it sounds like for you as well, for both of you, mm-hmm. is that because we got to hear from the players, because we got to hear from the writer, because we got to hear from the director, I felt really affirmed in where we all came to by the end of episode 52. I was like, huh. We were right. That yeah. is the purpose of this movie. That was,
yeah.
But I certainly felt different at the beginning of that conversation. I feel like the Fever, now I feel like I've gotten affirmation from all the people that yeah. were involved that, yeah. yes, this is what you were supposed to be looking for. And yes, feeling the shock and the disgust. That was okay, too.
Yes, you're supposed to feel disgust.
You can feel both of these things together and right. the relatability of it, which we'll talk about in a minute. I mean, yeah. the reason, like, what's yeah. the meaning of it. But it was like all the people who were a part of it officially were telling us, yes, it's all of it, guys. It's
yes,
all of it.
And I think here's a quote from the book that really made me feel better about the tussle that we had about, is this a disgusting movie or is this an important movie? Because the answer is both. And this comes from Barry Miller. I can't remember who he played. Somebody help me. Barry Miller. Well, one of the guys, one yeah. of John Travolta's friends. And he says, what really made the movie a valuable piece of filmmaking was that it emphasized the emptiness of that lifestyle. It's a tremendously ugly movie. And if I had had somebody tell me that, I wouldn't have had such
yeah.
conflict. Yeah.
Right, because I went into it thinking, well, this is like one of the best movies of all time. Right. I think I say in the episode I had yeah. seen that opening scene a lot. I do think in hindsight I had seen a lot of it, never all at once, but bits and pieces. The made for
the
TV
PG
which
version.
I want to talk about in a minute, yes. how they all felt when they were like, we're going to also film a version for television.
Yeah.
But I think if someone would have told me, it's okay to not like this movie, or it's okay to not to be disgusted by parts.
Yeah.
You know what
yeah.
I mean? I yeah. would have felt like, oh, I have permission. Instead, I was like, I'm supposed to be loving this movie.
Yeah. And I hate him. I hate him. Right. And I don't want or any
I
of
hate,
these. Yeah.
I hate him, or I hate not as much him. For me, it was always I hated the things coming out of his mouth.
Yeah.
I hated who he was pretending to be. Mm-hmm. I hated some of his friends. Mm-hmm. I hated that kind of stuff. But I was supposed to. Who knew?
Yeah, yeah. We didn't know that.
Well, I don't think that
I was given
the
permission.
Industry even helped us with that. I feel like the whole marketing of the movie mm-hmm. and the way that it was, especially when they realized it was getting some momentum and they made the PG version, they didn't harp or like let us feel that it was going to be icky. I never, until I was an adult watching it, didn't ever feel that way about Saturday Night Fever. It was a feel good, yeah, get on the dance floor
yeah.
kind of a movie. And to find yeah. out that mm-hmm. that was not the intent originally, but yet I feel like the powers that be manipulated that a little bit after it kind of took off in a way that I don't think anyone foresaw. And yeah. they kind of played into some parts of it that weren't really what it was meant to be in the beginning.
We got schnookered a little bit. They wanted, yeah. they wanted a wider audience. They wanted it to go to more theaters. And so Michelle will tell us about the PG version in a minute. But they filmed these two versions of the movie. So all of us children thought it was a joyful dance movie. And Margot, bless her heart, she goes right there. And there's a whole chapter called What's It All About, Tony? And she says the things that exemplify why we struggled. And I want to read this, just the beginning of that chapter so you can hear what I'm talking about. Okay, it's called What's It All About, Tony? Saturday Night Fever is a movie often remembered as a light disco flick with John Travolta in the white suit and wall-to-wall Bee Gees music. The sanitized television version has been viewed so often that it can come as a surprise to people when they watch the R-rated director's cut. Tony and the Faces, which are his friends, are not good people. Racist, sexist, homophobic, cruel barbarians who are filled with rage and self-loathing. The women in the story are desperate for the men to appreciate them. Stephanie is the modern girl who is being used by a man from her workplace and twice her age, so he will not have to pay a large alimony to his ex. We hear racial and homophobic slurs, witness awful sexual encounters, watch Tony scream at his mother for being a loser, and see a main character fall to his death because he cannot imagine marrying someone he impregnated. The film is downright ugly at times, and yet it is so relatable.
Yes.
Well, and I think we kind of came to that in
yes.
our episode 52.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I'm just wondering, listening to you guys over the past couple minutes, you know, we talk about Gene Siskel. This was his favorite movie
yes.
Forever of all time or whatever. And I think I start by like, I can't even imagine who would say that. Because I feel like as adults, you get that it's relatable because you've lived through experiences, right? But as children, I don't think you're getting that. You're not getting
no.
that this is relatable unless maybe you've lived through some of it. And I've learned now as an adult, instead of going like, I hate that character. I hate that. I say, God, so-and-so is such a tremendous actor because they're making me hate them so much.
They're doing
either
their
because
job.
Of mm-hmm. what they're doing or the yeah. way they're talking or how they're treating women or men or whatever. And so now that's sort of the lens I can see Saturday Night Fever through. Like I just said earlier, we were supposed to not like them. So now it's like, God, you guys all did a really good job.
Yeah, and that's where John Travolta ends up getting an Oscar nomination.
Yeah.
Because yeah. he was not, if you recall, he was Barbarino. He was not an Oscar-winning actor. And so Margot opens the book by discussing how John Travolta, this 22-year-old kid, like what is the transformation of this person from a sweat hog, essentially.
Yeah.
We've discussed John Travolta extensively in both our Saturday Night Fever episodes and also in our Urban Cowboy episode. But what Margot and Grease, oh my God, yes. But what Margot was able to show me was how in this moment, John Travolta was transforming from a sweat hog into, according to Margot, these are her words, into a lean, mean dancing machine / movie star, and how so many of the people in the industry did not see that coming. They mm-hmm. underestimated his growing star power. They just thought he was Barbarino from this dumb little sitcom.
But that right. that speaks to really his talent, because mm-hmm. everyone is seeing him as this doofus, Barbarino.
Yeah.
He wasn't at age, you know, 18, 17. He wasn't Barbarino. So
right.
he's really talented to be able, because he was like this really sweet guy. He in high school, you know, he was an outcast because all his friends were listening to rock music and he just wanted to listen to like Pirates of Penzance. He just wanted to be a musical theater boy. I was really shocked to hear, though, in Fever, that John Travolta was considered chubby pre-Saturday Night Fever.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I actually had to go back yesterday and watch some Welcome Back, Kotter, specifically clips of that famous Barbarino dance, which was always so funny. And, you know, he's a string bean.
Yeah, I don't know what that's all about.
It's about the 70s.
They were like, he had a big butt. Mm-hmm. They kept talking about his butt, apparently.
But that's part of the transformation, because he... Tony Manero, the character that he's playing in Saturday Night Fever, is chiseled. He is rock solid.
Yeah.
He is suave. He's got attitude that and swagger that Barbarino does not have. And that was work that the director and the crew had to do to get him prepared for this role. And John Travolta knew it. He had no intention of remaining a sitcom star. He wanted very badly to be a movie star. And so he was all in on this. So even that pose, if you think about his pose in the white suit on the movie poster, it's full of bravado. This wasn't what was showcased in the teen magazines or on Welcome Back, Kotter. He was a cute, lovable kind of rube. And by the way, not really a dancer at all.
Mm-mm.
So they have to both transform his body and they have to transform him into a dancer.
Hey, PCPS friends, it's Carolyn here. Did you know that I'm turning 60 this year? And to celebrate, I'm not buying a Trans Am or reliving my Aquanet years. I'm participating in the Chicago Marathon. And now before you picture me in one of those old Jane Fonda workout tapes with leg warmers and a sweatband, don't worry, I'll be wearing proper running shoes. Here's the real reason I'm doing this. I'm running to raise money for Down syndrome research through the Lumind Foundation. My inspiration is a very special little guy, my friend's grandson, baby Leo. Every time I lace up my shoes, I think of his smile. So here's where you come in. Just like we all chipped in for concert tickets or showed up with our quarters for Pac-Man, I'm asking you to show up for me and for Leo. Every donation, no matter how small, moves us closer to breakthroughs in Down syndrome research. You can find the link to donate in our show notes or head to the PCPS socials and click the link in bio. Help me make my 60th birthday about more than miles. Let's make it about love, hope, and the Gen X superpower of showing up. Because just like we learned from the Breakfast Club, we're stronger together.
And so they just put a call out there to say, hey, is there anybody who can teach this guy how to dance? And 26-year-old Denny Terrio, this is one of the biggest controversies in the whole saga of Saturday Night Fever, and I am so here for it. Because if you recall, in our episode, one of the remaining questions was, well, who choreographed Saturday Night Fever? Of course, Denny Terrio did. And we searched those credits, and we didn't find his name anywhere. We're like, what the hell? Where is Denny Terrio? He is nowhere in these credits.
Because he's told everybody he did.
Because he's a big, fat liar.
He's told everybody in, like, interviews
or whatever.
Yes, there's a mythology that was created by Denny Terrio himself. So he answers this call for somebody to teach John Travolta how to dance. Denny Terrio is not an instructor. He's not a choreographer, but he is part of a dance troupe called The Lockers, which, by the way, also included Tony Basil and Rerun from What's Happening.
Fred Berry. Yeah.
Fred Berry.
You can just picture Rerun's dance.
Yeah.
And then now that's how I picture The Lockers dancing.
Yes, that's exactly how it is. Exactly. So he works with Denny Terrio for a couple of weeks, but the director is concerned. Because when he's watching John Travolta dance with Denny Terrio, first of all, he says he's fat. He's too fat, which is such bullshit. And he's also like, he's breathing really hard.
He's out of breath.
He's not in very good shape. So they hire the guy who trained Sylvester Stallone for Rocky. They hire him to get John Travolta into shape. And that guy hated Denny Terrio.
Yeah, he basically said, like, everything. He's been teaching you to dance, right? But he says... he's not conditioning him, which makes a lot of sense because he has to have stamina, right? So if he's dancing and hitting his moves and hitting his finger pointing up and down, but he's out of breath, that's not going to play well to the cameras. So this guy, he ditches Denny Terrio. And he forbids him. He's like, I forbid you
from seeing Denny Terrio.
And he begins a 3-month training period with John Travolta, running, doing calisthenics, and John Travolta drops 30 pounds. But Denny Terrio, he still asserts he was a choreographer on Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah.
He actually even said, here's a quote from the book. He says, "Every dance move that John Travolta did in Saturday Night Fever came from me. The finger point, the splits, knee drops, I invented all of it." And that's from a Financial Times article in 2012. And Margot just says, the above statement by Mr. Terrio is utter nonsense. Because you guys, they say, I mean, I guess they had a few dance sections.
Yeah,
it's
they did.
True.
Yeah, and
for a few weeks. Several weeks in 1976.
And there's one photo. There's one photo of them together, which is what is the source of the mythology.
That's well, and John Travolta has acknowledged that.
Yes, he has.
He started it. And it does say, I think I read in both, in this book, Margot's book, I read, it was like after Welcome Back Cotter was rehearsed for the night, they would go and practice their dance moves. But that's his total involvement in the movie. Mm-hmm. Everybody, the eventual choreographer, Lester Wilson of Saturday Night Fever, says Denny Terrio never spent one day on the set.
Nothing. So, he's not in the credits. He's not on the movie. Uh-huh. He's not involved in the movie.
So we all believed, we were like, this is outrage. Where's his name in the credits? Because we've been hearing Denny Terrio tell us for years he did it. He didn't. So I mean, he did have a contribution because John Travolta has been very generous to include his name in people that helped him prep for the movie. Because he, at the end of the day, he did. But as far as the choreography of all those dance moves, and especially of all the rest of them, you know, Donna Pescau and all the guys who played the faces, they're like, we didn't know how to dance.
Yes.
We couldn't dance. He had a – so that was Lester Wilson.
The so what happened essentially was that Denny Terrio from then on packaged himself, literally packaged himself as the man who taught John Travolta how to dance. And his resemblance to John Travolta – and plus, this is very important, plus his friendship with Merv Griffin, talk show host Merv Griffin.
Well, we know all about that.
Is what sort of gave him the entree into the world of TV talk shows. And he started going on TV talk shows to both dance and talk about how he did Saturday Night Fever. And then, of course, Merv Griffin sees the rise of disco coming from this movie, and he wants to capitalize on it. So he knows exactly who to tap. He's going to take his buddy, who looks like John Travolta, and make a new show called Dance Fever, and it's all predicated on the fact that Denny Terrio taught John Travolta how to dance.
God, you guys listening, if you want just some good laughter, first of all, just go to the YouTubes and watch old episodes of Dance Fever, and then listen to our episode on Dance Fever because we're laughing until we can't breathe. Just describing how Denny Terrio half the time, it's like he's improvising.
It's horrible.
He doesn't know what he's doing. And so he just starts like doing the same move over and over. And they're not even like good moves.
No.
Yeah.
They're, we were really duped. I'm really.
Yeah. And then he kisses them all. Ugh, he's like the Richard Dawson of the dance TV shows. Gross.
And it is quite a disservice to the actual choreographer who really was responsible not just for that iconic dance solo that he did. He choreographed every movement of every person in the film. So that means the people on the dance floor, the extras who are on the dance floor, he's teaching them how to dance and giving them the moves that he wants them to do. He's trying to give the movie a certain flavor. That means he's choreographing John Travolta's movements that aren't even dance. So,
He's telling them how to put like a dollar on the table or how to put, you know, money in the strippers, you know.
And he is responsible for the swagger of that first scene with John Travolta walking with the paint cans. That's what establishes everything about this movie. And it's the choreographer who conceived of that and taught him to do that. He created the style, the aesthetic, the attitude, the movement. And unfortunately, his name gets lost in history. he was world famous. He was a hugely talented man, and he was so frustrated because Denny Terrio was out there telling people that he choreographed Saturday Night Fever. And mm-hmm. Denny Terrio, it wasn't just that he was misleading people. He actually made up shit. Like, he yeah. told people that he was fired from the movie. He told people that Lester Wilson, like, barred him from the set. None of this is true. He was mm-hmm. never a part of the movie.
He still doubles down on it from yes. what I've gathered. Yeah. It's mm-hmm. not like he said, oh, yeah, mm-hmm. gig's up. You've yeah. found all the evidence to not support me. No, he is yeah. dug
no,
in.
No, because it's not like it's his word against Lester Wilson's. Like, or because in Margot's book, like I said, she interviewed 62 people. And many of those people come out and say, no, he was yes. never on set.
Even Motion, one of the women from Motion, if you recall, Motion are the two women they're two women who dance with Denny Terrio on Dance Fever. And she actually was an ally of Lester Wilson's. She studied with him, and she said how painful it was to listen to Denny Terrio in interviews. Because she, you know, Motion, they're his arm candy. So they have to sit there with him, mouth closed, I'm sure, don't say a word, while he would spin these tales. And she's, in her own words, this is what she says: we had to sit there and listen to him blow smoke up his own butt.
You know what? It's shocking, isn't yeah. it, how someone can just lie and lie and lie, and everybody believes yeah. them.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And blow smoke up their own butt. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, I wanted to talk just a little bit about the R versus the PG
yeah.
rating, because I don't know that until 2022, when we recorded episode 52, that I was realizing that it wasn't just like then they took the actual version and they made some edited for TV. They actually shot many, many, many of the scenes side by side. And so the language in the R-rated Saturday Night Fever, which I think we can all agree is offensive with mm-hmm. a capital O. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about the swearing, because that doesn't fucking bother me at all. but the racist and sexist and homophobic and just wildly cringeworthy comments. It was very important to writer Norman Wexler and Robert Stigwood, who was the producer, as well as the actors, because they insisted it made this film gritty.
That was their intention.
Yes. Success, mm-hmm. right? I mean, for sure. I would say that's why we don't like them.
Right.
Because of all the stuff they're saying, which especially in today's climate is just like,
ooh, the characters you mean. You don't like the characters.
I don't like what's coming out of their mouths yeah, because it's constant racist, homophobic, you know, sexist,
vile.
Just slurs, mm-hmm. vile. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot more of those types of comments were more widely accepted in 1976 than they are today, but still awful. So when the director, John Badham, told them, he told the actors, okay, we're filming two versions, one rated R and one PG for TV. The actors got really upset. And so what you hear in the R-rated version, he says, is actually a lot worse than what was written in the script, because they just started throwing in more fuck yous and shits and everything, because they were like, fine, then let's go, right? Mm-hmm. And they actually resisted filming second takes, because remember, like I said, he's like, we're going to film it R-rated with all this, the language, but now we're going to film the PG, the TV version. And they resisted filming those second takes without the language, because they argued it's ruining the purity, the grittiness of this movie.
Which is why we're here. Like, this is what this movie is about.
Yes, that's what this story is. And actually, to be honest with you, I'm not sure it works that well without it, to be honest.
No, it doesn't.
But I think this is funny. They say once they learned about residuals, the director's like, let me tell you what a residual is, everyone. They got why it was important to film a TV-appropriate version, and then they were all, like, on board. And maybe that is another reason, too, that when I watched it, or the scenes I would see, the PG version, it doesn't really work. It doesn't make sense, because they're like, you need to know sort of how vile they all are.
Overcoming. What are we overcoming
exactly.
here?
And, yeah. and when I say how vile, I understand now it's because of the culture they were raised in and the positions they find themselves in and how they want out and blah, 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 blah. But it doesn't really work if they're not slurring and you know, slinging all these horrible phrases around. Mm-hmm. And the whole scene with Annette.
Yeah, there's no rape scene in the PG version.
It's two different movies. I mean, one is a film, I want to say, that has a plot and actors and all those things you were saying, the grit. The other one, to me, it's almost like you could fast forward through parts. There were moments, there were the scenes that we remember, the, you know, iconic dance scenes, all that other stuff. Who knows? I probably, if I had fast forward as an option, I maybe was not even listening.
The story
to some
wasn't
of those.
Important to you.
No,
you were
it
looking
was
for
more
the dance
the entertainment.
Scenes.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I bet I did the same thing, Carolyn.
Yeah,
like if someone had it on VHS, I was like, "Let's get to the dancing."
And I couldn't
and
have
the
told
Bee Gees
you.
Music.
I couldn't have told you what the story was. I had no idea until we watched the R-rated version, and I was like, "Oh my god!" I did not even know what this movie was about, and then I was harmed by the predicament of these people, but. I understood that there was now a story arc, that these people are trying to be, or at least Tony Manero, John Travolta, is trying to rescue himself from a life that he doesn't want. You don't get that in the PG version. You're just waiting for the dance scenes.
They have to be. There's no marriage of that story, what you just described, and the character. If they are not, you know, saying all the fuck yous and the slurs and the way they treat people, because you also aren't, like I said earlier, they didn't really expect you to like them. You didn't have to like them to understand how this was a relatable story for so many people.
Right.
So
right.
In that PG version, nothing, there was like, it wasn't copacetic, if that makes sense.
I think if you ask people that just kind of remember the PG version, I would have said, it's about a dance contest. Like I didn't need Donna Pascal's part.
What is she there for if there's no rape? Not that we wanted a rape scene, God. And that was one of the things in our episode that we did. Like, that rape scene was so painful. It was so painful. And it was very difficult for us to rationalize why we were sitting there watching it. But now you can understand that as a piece of the movie, it shows what Tony was trying to escape. I'm trying to escape being friends with people who rape people. I don't want to be friends with you people. Mm-hmm. You're not good people.
And it was also what, you know, it told so much about all of the characters in that one scene. I mean, yes, that is the major storyline, plot line, John Travolta's character trying to get out of all this. But it's also Donna Pascal playing that character so well in that scene and realizing the stuckness. I mean, that's also the part I came out of this with, is how everybody's kind of stuck and almost has to resign themselves. And maybe John Travolta's character is the one that sees some kind of way to get out of it. But it's this resignation of, you know, I'm a woman in this culture, in this environment. This is the way it's got to be. And it's just heartbreaking.
She says in Fever, because like we've said, listeners, Donna Pascal is someone she talked to. God, let's try to get her on the podcast. That would be kind of cool, right? Mm-hmm. And in Fever, it says, at one point, Tony asks her in the PG version. I think we all know how words change in the R version, but he asks her if she wants to be a good girl or a pig. She replies, I don't know, both. But in this world, she is stuck. If she doesn't get married and have babies soon, she'll be looked upon as an old maid. A horrible fate for nice Catholic girls. She believes she is aiming high with Tony because of his good looks, completely ignoring that the man and his friends are misogynist creeps who barely see women, even family members, as people. So she's stuck. She feels stuck. She's like, I don't want to do this, or I don't want to be chasing him, but I also don't want this other life. And there's a really great chapter in Fever all about Annette. And about that scene and about how it was shot, which you guys, like I said earlier, you know, I love all these behind the scenes things about the guys who play the faces that are in that car with her. But by now they've all gotten to be friends. And they just felt terrible. They felt awful. And they all just are so complimentary of Donna Pascal, like how she just was like, no, you just go for it. Like, you just have to, we have to do this. That helped. I love stuff like that too, though.
That helped me.
You guys are nice guys.
Yes.
Right.
These, it was sort of like being at camp. These people were all young. They're all in their early 20s and they're doing this project together over, it's something that's very important to them, and they become like campmates, like bunkmates, and they all love each other. And now five of them are supposed to rape their friend. And like you said, it was, how do you do that? They were acting, of course, but mm-hmm. how do you pretend that you're harming somebody that you now love? And it helped me so much to read that, because to their credit, when I'm watching it on screen, I hate them. I hate them.
Exactly. That's what mm-hmm. I was saying earlier. Yes. They're good actors then, mm-hmm. yeah.
So they've done their job, and it just soothes my soul a little bit to know that they didn't take that lightly, that that wasn't just, oh, it's the 70s and people got raped all the time, that it was something that they took seriously and it was not easy for them.
Mm-hmm. Right. And really very mature of them. One of the things that I learned that I was most surprised with was just how young and inexperienced this cast was in terms yes. of their acting. I mean, Paul Pape, who you referred to before, this was his first movie role. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not like they'd been gone to professional acting school for years and had all these films under yeah. their belt. These were young first timers, mostly because I think of this incredibly small budget that they had to work mm-hmm. with. I mean, I don't know that I realized until I read Margot's book is just how low budget it was, how quickly it had to be done. I mean, they started it March, filming in March and ended in May. When you think now of how long a movie takes to film, yeah. oh my gosh, mm-hmm. if that. I always feel bad for the actors when they have to go on, like do the press tour, because yeah. really they filmed the movie like 3 years before.
Yeah. How do they even remember?
Right, exactly.
And they've done so many other projects.
Yes. Since then. And so I'm amazed when I hear a lot of the casting, how it happened, and again, to this particular scene, how they were able to just portray it so well that we hated them and yeah. yet be these young kids. I mean, some of them living in Brooklyn because they acted the part. You know, they were thinking more mm-hmm. these people have to be believable as kids that would live in Bay Ridge. Of these guys that would live in Bay Ridge, even more so than maybe how they're going to portray yeah. some of these characters. And yeah. it just worked out. And that's kind of what I want to say about this book. What it taught me, or what I learned from it, was there was some part of the universe at work in making this movie what it was. Because I think that in and of itself, if it was just John Travolta as the lead actor, this movie isn't getting anywhere. If it was just the Bee Gees music, this movie isn't going to be what it was. If it was just, oh, disco is kind of up and coming and this movie's about disco, it wouldn't have been what it was. It was this alchemy of these different, totally different factors coming together at the same time in such a crucial way that made this beyond explanation. Like you have mm-hmm. to say, beyond serendipity or synchronicity, there was something magical that happened that brought these forces mm-hmm. together at the time for a $1 million movie that became so defining of a generation.
Yeah, and these were not, like you said, this was a low budget movie. So it's not like, oh, the Bee Gees were so huge and John Travolta exactly. was so huge. No, the Bee Gees were on their way out.
Exactly.
John Travolta was a sweat hog.
Right.
And all of these young actors that you talk about.
It's, yeah, you're not going to see Paul Pape.
No.
Because he was probably working in an ice cream store.
You don't know who he is.
Right.
And the Bee Gees were ascendant because of the alchemy that you talk about. And John Travolta was ascendant because of the alchemy that you talk about. Disco was ascendant because of the alchemy that you talk about. They even talk about how when they started filming the movie, their word of mouth about John Travolta being there grew to become unsustainable. And they had no idea. They didn't think anybody would even know who he was. Now, there could have been some more knowledge about John Travolta because the Sweat Hogs were supposed to be from Brooklyn. So it could be that the Brooklyn kids were holding on to John Travolta a little tighter than other kids around the country. But they said at one point, there was some woman that she talked to who was riding the bus to school one day, and the bus driver said, hey, did you hear they're filming a movie with John Travolta? And she said, nobody went to school that day.
I know,
they all skipped school, and they're all hanging on a subway platform. They're like they're mobbing the subway platform so they can watch the filming, so much so that the subway trains can't even get in. And the camera people said there was no way they could film the shot without having these kids hanging off the subway platform. This is all from a kid that people thought nobody knew about.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It was a complete surprise. And that's, you know, let's come full circle. That's all part of John Travolta's transformation from a sweat hog into an Oscar-nominated actor.
And how about this being like the first film opportunity like that that he gets, that it's such a rich part that he, anyone else playing this, I tell you, I don't think that we're going to be where we are. And another thing that Margot pointed out too was that television actors didn't go into film that easily.
No.
Like you were either a television actor or you were a film actor. So to go that back and forth was not that common. And also that the people that knew who John Travolta was were the younger people. And so initially Saturday Night Fever is not aimed at this group. It was the gritty kind of, you know, rated R adult angle that I think they were first going into this movie with. So I don't even know that when they hired John Travolta, I mean, what was it? $1 million a contract for three
for
films?
Three
to
movies.
Pay,
for three movies.
Yeah. Three movies.
In total.
So
in
they
total.
Weren't,
yeah.
He didn't know his value then, and they certainly didn't know his value. Mm-hmm. So I think that was all discovered after the fact that, and then again, because of all of those pieces that came together just at the right time. I mean, give it a year before, give it 6 months before, whatever.
Yes,
it's not going to be. Yes.
The timing was like the stars were aligning because he was positioning himself to not be a sitcom star. He had no intention of being a sitcom star. And they even offered, I didn't realize this, he was offered a spinoff, a Barbarino spinoff. And he said, no, thank you. I don't want to be a TV star. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be a movie star. Then a lot of you might remember that he had an album come out. You might remember his American Bandstand performance of Letter In. Remember Letter In?
Yeah.
And he was offered a mall tour. He was going to get $25,000 per mall to go on a mall tour with that album. And he said, no, I would rather go do summer stock so I can polish my acting skills. Like, he's got an idea in his head of where he wants to go. And it is not being a sweat hog.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So how lucky for him that this was the script that came his way.
Yeah.
Because we know some of the ones he did with Paramount after the fact were not that great.
Perfect.
And so, So I'm glad that this was the one that kind of put him on our screens, our big screens, and that people got to see him, because we talk about in our episodes what a great actor he is and his just his facial expressions.
Yeah. It was his on-ramp to being an actor instead of a sitcom star.
Right. So after listening to our original episodes that we did about the movie, we commented on the fact that we did not think that Karen Gorney, she was a good dancer, that she was a good actor. And so I found her little story that Margot was able to unveil some interesting tidbits about how she got the job. I found those interesting. And I think they backed up the fact that I don't think she still is a good actor, and I don't think she's a good dancer. And we, at first, Kristen, you were doing your very highbrow. They cast her as a non-dancer because, you know, she was a poser.
Yeah,
she was a poser. Uh-huh. And I'm thinking, no, she was sleeping with the director, and
this
she just happened to get in a taxi with, you know, Robert Stigwood's nephew or something, who said, oh, I'm doing a movie. And she says, oh, am I in it? And all of a sudden she has a job, and then, so there,
this is how she gets the job, literally.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the fact that she couldn't dance became a real problem on the set. Whereas in retrospect, I do think it's kind of a good device if she's not a perfect dancer. It makes it a little more interesting about what their story arc is. Yeah. But I made that up. So, and
you
that's
did.
Not true.
except for the thing I always will have a problem with is that they talk about what a great dancer she is, don't they?
Yes,
like
they
several
do. They
times.
Say she's a good dancer.
Oh, she's like an amazing dancer. And we're watching it going, no, she's not.
It's
well,
very
that's
obvious
that, director
that she's not.
Keeps telling her she's a good dancer and tells everyone to tell her she's a good dancer. I feel like that was Yeah,
they
that
even
was just
said
appeasing
that
him.
After Saturday Night Fever, this is where you're drinking the Kool-Aid and you're surrounding yourself with yes people. After Saturday Night Fever, she tried to pursue dance a little more deeply as a career, and she even became a ballet instructor. And I was like, no, you did not. Did you see that plié? She
with
remember?
With Denny Terrio.
Yes.
She became an instructor.
We had a whole conversation in our episode about how she couldn't even do a plié. And I was like, there's somebody on set who can say, do it like this. But they didn't.
Because they were afraid to, I'm thinking.
I think it's possible because she was sleeping with the director. Yeah. Now, I don't want to disparage her because we don't know that they were doing it, but there was a relationship.
Maybe they were just sleeping.
It could be
they were just sleeping.
They were sharing a bed. Mm-hmm. But it does shed light on it. But it caused a lot of problems because she has to keep up with John Travolta, who is now trained extensively. And the choreographer has said, the words were something like, she just didn't understand her own body. They couldn't teach her. She wasn't even teachable.
And it was very fast, right? It was only a couple of weeks before they started shooting that she was even cast. So she didn't have these months of preparation that, you know, John Travolta had.
So you'll see in the movie that there is a place where she doesn't lift up her head and you can't see her face and she has funny hair. That's because it's a body double. Because she could not master this dance routine believably. She couldn't
put a wig
do
on
it.
Denny Terrio?
Yeah. That would be hilarious.
He was probably so pissed.
Yeah. I could be Karen Lynn Gorney. And the person who was the superior dancer was Donna Pascal.
Yeah.
She was really quite good and she could keep up with him. And that scene where she's dancing with John Travolta is adorable. And that's where you really become a fan of Annette/Donna Pascal. You're like, I really want the best for her. And then he just shits on her.
Tony.
So there's one chapter in Margot's book that we're not going to talk about today because I think it deserves its own episode. We've only ever touched upon and danced around the 1983 debacle/sequel to Saturday Night Fever called Stayin' Alive. It is a bonkers movie.
Carolyn and
Margot,
and I are shaking our heads.
I know. And please understand, I loved this movie.
I lapped it up.
But it was horrible. It was really, really bad. But I didn't care. I loved it. But Margot has a whole chapter devoted to it. And she answered so many questions for me. Like I said, it's either a beloved movie or a much maligned movie. And it went kind of strangely under the radar, given that it was the sequel to one of the biggest movies of all time. And in my original conclusion for this episode, I had written this gracious invitation to Margot to join us again so we could talk about her chapter on Stayin' Alive. I am so sad that we can't make that happen. But in tribute to her and her beloved Brooklyn, we look forward to another Disco Book Club featuring her book Fever and Margot's research on Stayin' Alive.
I'll watch it.
Yeah, for sure.
And I'll try not to hate watch
to.
It.
Yeah.
But I kind of want to now.
No, hate watching, it would be easy to hate watch it. And it's funny because I'll reference this again, in the chapter they do say, for some reason, people have memorized pieces of dialogue from that movie, despite the fact that it is so much maligned. And as soon as I read that, the lines started coming out of my mouth. I wrote it. I actually wrote the lines in the margins of the book. I knew the dialogue.
Here's a question for you then, Kristen. Pirate movie with Christopher Atkins and Christy McNichol or Stayin' Alive?
Stayin' Alive.
Which is better or worse?
Well, what depends on your definition.
Or are they about the
same? apples and oranges a little bit?
Okay. Yeah,
apples
probably,
and oranges. Yeah. But what am I going to enjoy more? Definitely Stayin' Alive.
Sure.
It is bonkers, and we'll talk about it someday.
Okay, we'll do it sometime, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of enjoying, we think that you all will enjoy reading Fever, A Complete History of Saturday Night Fever, and you can purchase that wherever you buy your books. But we would love you to consider buying it from bookshop.org using the links that you can find in our show notes, on our website, and in our link tree on Instagram and Facebook. because buying from bookshop.org benefits small, independent bookshop owners instead of billionaires. And when you use our links, those proceeds are also shared with us. So this is another way that you can help support this podcast, and we greatly appreciate it.
And we have a whole shop on bookshop.org. So we have many other books that if you're a reader, you like books about Gen X pop culture history, or just a lot of the books that the three of us, we're all avid readers, so the three of us are loving, go check out our shop on bookshop.org. And we would also like to thank our supporters on Patreon who pledge monthly donations to help us pay our bills. You can find a link to our Patreon page and all the places Carolyn just mentioned, show notes, website, and Linktree. And one of the ways we say thank you is by mentioning a group of them by name at the end of each episode. So today we're giving a special shout out to Joy, Carrie, Carol with a K, Terry, Victor, Colleen, Tam, Lisa, Kieran, Carolyn, Diane, Jill, Terry with an A, T-A-R-I, Teresa with an H, and Deb.
Thank you, everybody. In the meantime, let's raise our glasses for a toast. Margot Donahue, author of
for sure.
Fever, A Complete History of Saturday Night Fever, and courtesy of the cast of Three's Company, to good times.
To happy days.
To Little House on the Prairie.
Thanks, everybody.
Cheers, everyone.
The information, opinions, and comments expressed on the Pop Culture Preservation Society podcast belong solely to Carolyn, the Crushologist, and Hello Newman, and are in no way representative of our employers or affiliates. And though we truly believe we are always right, there is always a first time. The PCPS is written, produced, and recorded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the fictional WJM Studios and our beloved Mary Richards. Nanu Nanu, keep on truckin', and may the force be with you. If you like what you hear, let us know by becoming an official supporter of the Pop Culture Preservation Society on Patreon. This show is created, researched, produced, distributed, edited, and paid for by us, Kristen, Carolyn, and Michelle. And your support allows us to keep the lights on and keep on trucking. For the price of one or two cups of coffee a month, you can become a supporter by going to poppreservationists.com and clicking on the Patreon link. Or go to our link in bio on Instagram and find the Patreon link in our Linktree. We appreciate you, and thank you so much for helping us do what we love.